From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd, in for Robin Young.
And I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. The mayors of at least 30 cities, including Los Angeles, Atlanta, and Pittsburgh, are planning to present a plan to the United Nations to meet the targets in the Paris Climate Accord that President Trump decided to pull out of. Tesla CEO Elon Musk and Walt Disney CEO Robert Iger said they would leave White House advisory councils after the decision. The president made an economic case for leaving the agreement, and joining us now is an economist who sees things differently. Larry Summers, former Treasury Secretary under President Clinton and President Emeritus of Harvard University. He also served as one of President Obama's chief economic advisors. Larry Summers, welcome back.
Glad to be with you.
And what was your initial reaction to President Trump pulling the United States out of the Paris Agreement?
I was horrified. There are occasionally moments that signify very big things. When the United States voted down the League of Nations, that was one of those things. And it's at least possible that this will be remembered as the day that the President of the United States signaled that the United States was going to be taking a very different attitude towards the global system than it has since the Second World War. The 75 years since the Second World War have been the best period for mankind in terms of prosperity created, in terms of peace maintained, and the best period for the United States as well on those dimensions. And this action represents a dramatic change in strategy, and that is very dangerous. We will live in a poorer, more dangerous, and less safe world as a consequence of today's action. I believe it's the biggest U.S. foreign policy error since the Iraq War, and its consequences will be of even longer duration.
What about what the president said, though, about possibly negotiating some new agreement?
It's a crude fiction. 190 countries who reached an agreement that we just wantonly withdraw from because we want to are very unlikely to negotiate a new agreement with us. If every international agreement is up for grabs and open for renegotiation at all times, there never will be an international system with international agreements. We will not have our current president forever, and I suspect at some point the United States will rejoin the 190 nations and break off its partnership with Syria and Nicaragua, which is what we're now in, by rejecting this agreement.
One of the cases that the president made in pulling the United States out of the agreement was that he believes it would hurt U.S. jobs. He believes the U.S. is subsidizing developing countries too much. And then he said this about the idea of using more renewable energy. He says it's not sufficient to grow the economy. Let's listen.
At 1% growth, renewable sources of energy can meet some of our domestic demand. But at 3 or 4% growth, which I expect, we need all forms of available American energy, or our country will be at grave risk of brownouts and blackouts. Our businesses will come to a halt in many cases.
How do you respond to that, Larry Summers?
President's comments are nonsense. The United States isn't going to grow at 3 to 4% over a sustained period. The only times in its history when it did were moments when the adult population was growing far faster than it is now. We've never had 3 years in a row of growth per member of adult population as fast as he's predicting for seven. The Paris Agreement doesn't stop us from using fossil fuels. And so if we were to grow, we might have a bit higher energy prices, but there's nothing that would necessitate brownouts and blackouts. And the truth is that renewable energy is the future. Already, the renewable energy sector is 4 or 5 times as large in terms of jobs as the coal sector. And by shutting ourselves off from that, limiting our ability to export, we're doing far more damage than any gain that could come. The president's claim is based on a fictional forecast and a contrived and inaccurate economic analysis. It will not stand scrutiny by any serious observer.
One more thing while we have you. Are you expecting the tax cut package that President Trump has been promising to actually happen?
I'd bet against it because rationality will prevail. Our problem, what's holding back American business, is not a cost of capital caused by high taxes. The problem is lack of investment opportunity. And that's what we need to work on, whether it's with infrastructure, whether it's with strengthening our workforce, whether it's with raising the level of demand in the economy, whether it's by promoting exports. It's not high costs of capital caused by taxation that are holding businesses back. If that was what was holding businesses back, you'd expect to see a weak stock market. And that's certainly not what we have.
That's Larry Summers, former U.S. Treasury Secretary and President Emeritus of Harvard University. Thanks so much, as always, for joining us.
Good to be with you. Thanks a lot.
Voters in several Mexican states go to the polls this weekend to pick new governors. The races will be key for the country's president, Enrique Peña Nieto, and his embattled party. Scarred by corruption scandals and rising crime, the ruling PRI party is in a fight for its political future. NPR's Carrie Kahn has this report on the governor's race in the state of Mexico, the most populous and politically important in the country.
Mexico State, which encompasses some of the richest and poorest suburbs of the country's capital, has long been a breeding ground for the ruling party's elite. Current President Enrique Peña Nieto hails from there. He's a former governor, and his PRI party has ruled the state and its rich coffers for more than 80 years. That's making this Sunday's vote as much a referendum on Peña Nieto's rule as well as a bellwether for next year's presidential contest.
Delfina! Delfina!
Hundreds gather at a campaign rally for 54-year-old Delfina Gomez, a former schoolteacher whose modest background and political outsider status is fueling her numbers in the polls. She's either in the lead or running a very close second. Her biggest asset, however, is her benefactor, and some say puppet master, Andrés Manuel López Obrador. The two-time unsuccessful presidential candidate is a firebrand leftist and anti-corruption crusader whose populist message is gaining ground. Rene Sandoval, a 34-year-old shoe repairman who came to the rally, says it's time for a change. The corruption in Mexico has gone on too long and is holding us back, says Sandoval. He hopes Gomez, with López Obrador's help, will turn things around.
They have mounted a bid that seems perhaps on the verge of succeeding.
Based on a simple message, says Denise Dresser, a political science professor at Mexico's Autonomous Technological Institute.
We are different. We are not a conventional party, riding the crest of a wave that is not only Mexican, it's international.
Dresser says a win for López Obrador's candidate this weekend would give him front-runner status ahead of next year's presidential race, and it would deal a huge blow to Peña Nieto's party. Such an outcome has sent chills through the halls of the ruling party and has put the full force of the PRI's formidable political machine into high gear. That was evident in the PRI party's campaign closer this week, held on a huge soccer field at one of the state's public colleges. Hundreds of buses, vans, and PRI-controlled union taxis hauled in thousands to attend the rally. Tacos and sandwiches were free-flowing during the long rides. Thousands stream onto the field wearing free baseball caps and campaign T-shirts emblazoned with candidate Alfredo Del Mazo's picture and fist raised high over his Get Tough on Crime slogan, which they chant repeatedly during the rally. Undaunted by the current president's historically low approval ratings and high crime wave in the state, Del Mazo doesn't shy away from mentioning Peña Nieto and spins his own political lineage as valued experience. His dad and grandfather are former Mexico state governors, and Peña Nieto is a distant cousin. With five other candidates on the ballot, including two independents, it's unlikely anyone will win a majority, and the winner could take the country's biggest state prize with less than 30% of the vote. Carrie Kahn, NPR News, Ecatepec, Mexico.
This week, operators of the Three Mile Island nuclear plant said it will close ahead of schedule, unable to compete with cheap natural gas. The plant is notorious as the site of a partial meltdown in 1979. This is what it sounded like on NBC.
In a nuclear power plant near Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, the cooling system broke down this morning. Some radioactive steam escaped into the air.
Nobody died in the accident, but Three Mile Island remains the site of the worst nuclear disaster in U.S. history, and now the plant's operators say they will close in 2019. It hasn't turned a profit in 5 years. For more on this, we're joined by John Larson. He's director of the Rhodium Group. And John, when you heard the news about Three Mile Island closing this infamous power plant in the country, what'd you think?
Yeah, I mean, it's probably the most notorious power plant in the United States. It's been on the margin, on the ropes for a couple of years now. Exelon, the company that owns Three Mile Island, had notified regulators that it had not met eligibility requirements to get additional compensation payments out of the electric power markets for the last couple of years. And that's usually a red flag that a plant is unlikely to stick around for much longer. And that happened again last month, and that was basically the final straw, signaling that Three Mile Island just isn't a profitable plant anymore.
Well, we're seeing that since 2013, six nuclear reactors in the United States have shut down after struggling to turn a profit. Wasn't that long ago that people were pretty bullish on nuclear. So what's your prospects for it?
Right. I think the kind of trends that have been leading to the plant closures you just described in Three Mile Island, and we've got another five power plants slated to retire currently by 2025. And at Rhodium Group, we've got another 17 gigawatts of power plants, nuclear power plants, at risk of retirement over the next 15 years. And all of that is because of these market forces: cheap natural gas, cheap renewables, not enough increases in demand for electric power. These nuclear plants used to be cheap, relatively speaking, but as other power sources from renewables and gas are now outcompeting, nuclear doesn't look as cheap as it used to.
Well, it's interesting because most of the news that we hear about natural gas competing with other forms of energy is in the coal industry. Last month, I was reporting in Arizona on the pending closure of a coal plant there. It's the Navajo Generating Station. It's the largest coal plant in the West. And the question that comes up when I see these closures is that the power that these plants are providing still needs to come from somewhere. So how can we afford to lose them?
Yes. The market is remarkably good at allowing competition to find ways to fill the gaps. Electric demand in the U.S. has largely been flat over the last decade. So you're not having increased demand for power. It's all you just have to backfill what you're losing from these power plants. And in the meantime, the cheapness of natural gas and the cost reductions for wind and solar have really made it very economical to build these new plants to fill in the gap.
Well, you know, utilities and energy companies then are making long-term decisions. They're shutting down some infrastructure and they're building, as you say, these new plants, which have got to cost billions of dollars. And they're doing that based on the price of natural gas today. Is there a cautionary tale at all that this is a good plan in the long run? Because the price of natural gas, as you know, can fluctuate quite a bit.
I can. I mean, you know, like with anything, you don't want to put all your eggs in one basket. But I think some context is important here. In 2016, natural gas generated about a third of total U.S. electricity, and coal is about a third. As trends continue and you see gas, you're going to see gas playing a bigger role, but it's unlikely to take over the entire grid anytime soon. And in fact, over the last 3 years, renewable energy power plants have actually been the dominant source of new electricity in the United States. We've been building more wind and solar than we've been building gas.
Hmm. How will all of that play into President Trump's decision to pull out of the Paris Climate Accord yesterday?
Well, you know, in 2016, CO2 emissions in the power sector were the lowest they've been since the early 90s, in large part due to the factors we've just been talking about: cheap natural gas, increasingly cheap renewables, and flat electric demand. Those three trends aren't going to change anytime soon. Natural gas prices are likely to stay cheap in the near future. Solar and wind are only getting cheaper. And electric demand, there's really, in absence some gigantic economic recovery, we really don't see a change there. And so I think you're going to see CO2 emissions continue to go down in the power sector, absent additional federal action to deal with emissions elsewhere in the economy. We are not quite going to be on track to get anywhere close to where we would have been under the Paris commitments. The numbers we've put together at Rhodium Group, the best case scenario is about 18 to 19% below 2005 levels by 2025. That's a long way from where we need to be, both on the science level and also in what we would have achieved under the Paris goals.
That's John Larson, director of the Rhodium Group. John, thank you.
You're welcome. Thanks, Peter.
Well, comedian Kathy Griffin held a press conference today after getting a lot of criticism for posting a photo and video where she's holding a fake bloody head resembling President Trump. She said today the way she's been treated isn't fair, and she called the president a bully.
What's happening to me has never happened ever in the history of this great country, which is that a sitting president of the United States and his grown children and the First Lady are personally trying to ruin my life forever.
Griffin also said she stands by her apology from earlier this week, which she posted on Instagram.
Hey, everybody, it's me, Kathy Griffin. I sincerely apologize. I am just now seeing the reaction of these images. I'm a comic. I cross the line. I move the line. Then I cross it. I went way too far.
Even after that apology, CNN fired her as co-host of its New Year's Eve special. Joining us now is Kate Summers-Dawes, deputy managing editor at Mashable. She's in San Francisco on Skype. Hi, Kate.
Hi, Jeremy.
And Griffin, at one point, broke down in tears in that press conference, saying a bunch of old white guys are trying to silence her. What did you think of how this has played out over the course of this week?
It's obviously been really divisive all week, with mostly the internet divided, you know, sort of united against her. And this is the first time I've seen, during the course of this press conference, a few tweets starting to pop up online that are saying things like, "I stand with Kathy Griffin. I support you, Kathy Griffin." I saw one Twitter user write, "If I ever say the wrong thing, I'm calling Kathy Griffin's lawyer. She's crushing it," which is definitely a change from what we've seen throughout the week.
Well, and it does get to this question of what is too far? Where is the line? Which she clearly feels that she crossed, and so do many, many other people. But she did have one defender this week. This is actor and comedian Jim Carrey speaking to Entertainment Tonight at the premiere of the Showtime series he's producing. Let's listen.
I think it is the job of a comedian to cross the line at all times, because, you know, that line is not real. And if you step out into that spotlight and you're doing the crazy things that he's doing, you know, we're the last line of defense, and really the comedians are the last voice of truth in this whole thing.
So there's one defender. I did notice, you know, even journalists, straight journalists, were coming out and saying this was way over the line. She's very wrong. Not so many people saying what Jim Carrey has been saying.
Yeah, Jim Carrey was sort of the lone voice out there. And as you mentioned, you know, people from as diverse as Chelsea Clinton to Mitt Romney were coming out and saying this is vile, this is wrong, this is vulgar, which is why she apologized, it seems. And so there hasn't been much support for her, though I did see a couple of, a couple of users come out and say, "Good on Jim Carrey. Comedians should be allowed to make ugly, bad jokes," which is sort of the crux of his argument and the crux of the argument for satire and really freedom of expression.
I got to ask you about one more thing while we have you, which is covfefe, which President Trump tweeted out around midnight on Wednesday. There's been some debate about what it meant. I think he probably just fell asleep while he was typing. But it came up on The Daily Show in this spoof of the National Spelling Bee.
The National Spelling Bee could all come down to this. For the win.
Your word is covfefe.
Can you use it in a sentence?
Despite the constant negative press, covfefe.
Can you use it in a full sentence?
No.
So, I mean, this is probably the biggest social media story we've ever had in our segment.
That's right. So, Jeremy, you don't think that was the Secret Service tackling him as he was beginning to tweet at midnight?
Oh, it's possible, I guess, yeah.
It's possible. Yeah, there's a... As you said, this has just been the biggest story of the week online, just an astronomical level of reaction. And I think, you know, my opinion is that part of that is due to just there's been so much dark political news lately and people were ready for a joke, a little bit of escapism, a little bit of fun, mostly at the expense of the president. Oliver Willis tweeted an image of the glowing Saudi orb with that Trump put his hands on while he was in Saudi Arabia last week. And his caption was, quote, "And the orb, having bestowed upon you the power to smite your enemies, can be invoked using the simple code word, hashtag covfefe," or covfefe, or however
or whatever it is. Kate Summers-Dawes, Deputy Managing Editor at Mashable, thanks so much.
Thanks so much, Jeremy. Enjoyed being here.
The unemployment rate has hit a 16-year low. It fell to 4.3% last month, according to new numbers from the Labor Department today. But the economy added fewer jobs than economists expected last month, 138,000. Michael Regan is senior editor at Bloomberg News. He joins us from New York. Hi, Mike.
Hi, Jeremy.
And what do you make of these numbers?
Well, I think I would just repeat what you said. I mean, unemployment at a 16-year low is just unequivocally a good thing, a sign of a strong economy. I'd point out also another measure called the U6 rate. Now, this tracks people who are working part-time but would actually prefer full-time work. That also hit the lowest level in a decade of about 8.4%. So when employment is this low, it's sort of natural that the number of jobs being added each month will start to decline. So it's not too surprising that the headline number of job additions was a little lower than it has been. To me, sort of the puzzling and potentially disappointing bit is that wage growth is still relatively weak at about 2.5%. When unemployment is as low as it is, it makes you wonder where is the wage inflation that will put more money in people's paychecks. And it's just not quite there yet.
Well, where are the jobs? Where are the biggest job gains and losses when you look into the numbers?
One of the big sectors is healthcare. Jobs in that sector rose by about 24,000. And this has been a strong sector for a while, obviously in large part because of the aging baby boom population. But some of the other strength was in professional and business services. It's a broad category, but that continued to trend very high, 38,000 jobs added. On the ho-hum side, jobs in construction, manufacturing, and finance were little changed.
So the Fed is holding a meeting later this month. It is expected to raise interest rates again. What do you think the Fed is going to take away from today's jobs report?
Yeah, I think the vast consensus of opinion I've read and all the market sort of metrics you can look at point to a lot of confidence that they'll increase the benchmark rate another quarter percentage point this month. There is a little bit of debate about whether they will raise it again this year after that. The odds are looking about 50-50 on that. And part of it will depend on what happens with the debt ceiling later in the year. If there is a lot of problems with that and a potential government shutdown, then that could maybe cause them to pause and not raise again this year. So we'll have to wait and see.
And there are reports that they're also considering reducing the size of their enormous multi-trillion-dollar balance sheet, which they've been, you know, buying up assets ever since the financial crisis to try to prop up parts of the economy.
Right. Everyone's expecting that to be sort of their next move, if not after this rate increase, certainly late this year, early next year. And that could serve the same function as raising interest rates to some degree.
Mike, just in the few seconds we have left, we saw the Dow, S&P and NASDAQ all close at record highs yesterday. What's going on in the markets?
Well, obviously, you know, the sum of the economic data hasn't been stellar lately, but it's not really raising any red flags about a recession anywhere on the horizon. I hate to say that out loud because you don't want to jinx it,
right.
But that seems to be the takeaway.
That's Mike Regan, senior editor at Bloomberg News. Mike, thank you.
Thank you.
Louisiana lawmakers have given a green light to a 50-year, $50 billion coastal restoration plan a day after President Trump pulled the United States out of the Paris Climate Accord. State officials say routine flooding from rising seas and eroding coastlines could make everyday life in some places impossible in the coming decades. And that's the subject of a series that we're continuing today. On a recent trip to Louisiana, Wendell Curall told me that part of the problem is that generations of flood protection along the Mississippi River have prevented the flow of sediments that help build up the land. He's on the state board that wrote the restoration plan.
We have a subsidence rate in some places, like right here in Leeville, just down the bay, a few miles. Over the last 100 years, we may have lost in some places as much as 4 feet of elevation. But of that 4 feet, 3 feet is to subsidence, maybe 1 foot to sea level rise. So the important thing to understand for South Louisiana is that if you think about the land loss as a cake, well, subsidence is the cake and sea level rise is the icing.
To see what Curall was talking about firsthand, I drove to Leeville.
Well, gentlemen, we've been waiting for y'all this 15 minutes.
And I met Harris Sheremy, owner of the local seafood joint. He sat on the front porch of his restaurant with the sun setting behind him, greeting customers who just spent a long day on the water.
Right now is the best time of fishing in Leeville. Of course, Leeville is the best time to fish.
Right.
Any time of the year. Yeah. Anywhere in the United States.
No matter what, we come here, we catch fish.
This is the only place in the world you can catch the fish that you catch. If you like to fish speckled trout and redfish.
That's right.
This is the place.
That's right.
And he's right. This is a unique place. Leeville is a mix of industry and natural beauty. Out here, oil wells pop up from the shallow salt marshes just a few miles from a pass that leads to open water in the Gulf of Mexico.
I've been here all my life. And I enjoy it. I would not move to anywhere else. I like the atmosphere and the marsh.
You're 72 years old. How much have you seen this place change?
Oh, Lord. Change. The land was high. A lot of marsh. Now, right now, they built a new bridge going to Fushun. And as you ride the bridge, you can see the marsh. There's none. Strictly water. 25 years ago, there was just strictly marsh. There's no water. The only thing we had was the blowout, we used to call, where a rig blew up and made a hole. It was this big sinkhole. But you couldn't get to it by water. You had to walk to the place. Now it's strictly water. You got to go by boat. It starts from the highway and goes miles and miles to the east.
And because of that, you've got more flooding than you used to.
Oh, yes. Our town of Leeville is sinking a half an inch a year. The wind is stronger. The tides are stronger. The pass is a lot wider and a lot deeper, so it provides a bigger volume of water to come in. I often have 2 or 3 feet of water in my parking lot.
Just recently you did.
Recently, three weeks ago. I had water all the way up to our porch here on the restaurant.
And that never used to happen before?
Not at all. We've been here going on the 21st year, and it has started with the last year and a half, 2 years. But that's not the major problem. The major problem is the subsiding of our land. When I was growing up, 10, 12 years old, in order to get to the water to your boats, you had to go down. You had to carve steps. Now it's even. They took out so much oil and leave it. So much oil out of Temple Island and golden metal that they all produced a cavity. It's like a balloon full of water. You take the water out, you'll have an empty cavity and it's going to fall. And that's what's happening now.
Well, and you're a business owner. This is your restaurant, and now it's flooding. So what does that mean for you? When your restaurant floods, what happens?
And people are not going to come to the restaurant with a foot of water, much less 3 feet of water. It kills our business.
Do you have insurance?
Yes, we have flood insurance. Thank God.
There's another issue going on here. The price of oil is really low. A lot of people losing jobs. What does that mean for you?
Let me take the example. I usually keep coming on weekends. Fridays, 130 to 150. Friday nights, Saturday night, the same thing. This year, all year long, we hit 100 one time. Now, tonight, it looks like it's a pretty good night. We might serve 40 people, but we usually serve 60, 70 people for a weeknight. Now, since the oil prices dropped, people are losing their homes, they're losing their boats. In fact, last week, we had a company that let go 17 people, a company that we've been feeding for 10 years, and they had to cut it out because it was costing them too much, and they let go 17 employees.
Harris Sheremy, owner of the Leeville Seafood Restaurant. You can hear much more from the people I met on that trip to Louisiana's bayou at hereandnow.org.
Well, in many parts of the country, cicadas emerge from the ground every 17 years. But this spring in the Washington, D.C. area, thousands of them have been showing up 4 years ahead of schedule. Jacob Fenston from Here and Now contributor WAMU reports.
If you've lived through a big cicada year, you can probably remember the deafening roar they make. But this is what a single cicada sounds like just after it emerges from the earth.
Okay, well, this guy I picked off my neighbor's pin oak tree this morning. There were literally thousands on that tree today.
Mike Raup is an entomology professor at the University of Maryland, known as the bug guy. He's squeezing the cicada to make it sing as its beady red eyes glint in the sun. The creature has been underground for the past 13 years, growing and sustaining itself by sucking the juice from tree roots. Now it will live for just a few weeks out in the open air.
We're going to see romance in the treetops. We're going to see mating rituals.
Very noisy mating rituals. Then the adults will die and the baby nymphs will drop from the treetops to burrow underground for another dozen plus years.
So it's got all the elements. It's got drama. It has birth. It has death. It's just a spectacular natural event. All elements of nature are seen right here in these periodical cicadas.
There are cicadas every summer in D.C. and lots of the country. Those insects are known as annual cicadas, and you hear them later in the summer. But periodical cicadas only appear in Washington every 17 years as part of Brood 10. Their last emergence was in 2004, so their next appearance should be in 2021. So for a lot of people, it was a bit of a surprise to see at least some of that brood coming out 4 years early. Gene Kritsky was not one of those people.
Back in 1991, well, they go back even further.
Kritsky is an entomology professor in Ohio at Mount St. Joseph University. Back in the 90s, he and his students were digging up cicadas all over the state. They knew exactly how far along the bugs should be in their 17-year development.
And much to my surprise, they were growing faster.
Every year, they were bigger than they should have been.
Then in the year 2000, I went on Cincinnati television and said, I'm expecting cicadas to come out 4 years early. And they did, in big numbers.
Now, 17 years later, he says the same thing's happening as he expected it would, and he thinks it's related to higher ground temperatures due to climate change.
We can't say what's causing that increase in temperature, but we know from everything from USDA growing charts to weather, historical weather data, that indeed we are having warmer temperatures, and the cicadas are responding accordingly.
But another reason we're seeing more cicadas may be that we're looking for them more. John Cooley is a researcher at the University of Connecticut and runs the website magiscicada.org, which crowdsources cicada spottings. He says if you zoom in on Washington on the website's map right now, the region is completely obscured by little cicada icons.
So many reports are coming in from Washington, they're actually knocking off the reports from the real Brood 6 down in North Carolina.
The real Brood 6 is the one that's expected this year south of the Washington, D.C. region, and that will number in the billions of bugs. Cooley suspects a bias in his crowdsourced data. In places where people are plugged in and highly educated, they're more likely to go online and report cicada sightings. Plus, this is Washington, so cicadas can seem to take on an added significance.
There's always this sort of mythology around them that they are harbingers of bad or war or something like that. So that when they come out in Washington, D.C., it gets people into a bit of a stir.
It's also exciting for people who study bugs, says Mike Raup at the University of Maryland.
Whenever the cicadas are out, man, it's like our field day. There's nothing else like this in the entire universe. So for entomologists, I think this is our Super Bowl, kind of.
The real Super Bowl will come in 4 years when billions of Brood 10 cicadas emerge. This year is more like a scrimmage. For Here and Now, I'm Jacob Fenston in Washington.
The summer TV season is underway, and that means networks are rolling out dozens of new shows. It's NPR TV critic Eric Deggans' job to watch all those shows and then help us make sense of them. Eric, welcome back.
Glad to be here.
So let's start with a familiar name.
Jennifer Lopez, global pop phenomenon who sold over 80 million albums worldwide, movie icon and TV superstar who got her break as a professional dancer.
I started as a dancer, and I know it takes commitment, passion, heart. There's been dance shows, but we wanted to create the Olympics of dance.
Go J-Lo.
I
Go
know.
J-Lo.
We have to watch another dance competition show?
Well, I mean, you don't have to. NBC is hoping you will. Whenever I watch one of these unscripted competition type shows, I always sort of ask myself, like, what's the engine that's going to drive people to see this? When you watch The Voice, it's very clearly about the judges and hanging out with them and sort of basking in their clever celebrity. And it's not so much about the contestants. American Idol was sort of the converse. It was much more about the singers than the celebrity judges. You know, here it's hard to sort of understand, like, what is going to make people want to watch this. You know, J-Lo is, of course, being J-Lo. And they present these dancers that are already very good. You're not seeing people who are amateurs kind of mature like you would on an American Idol or Voice. You're seeing dancers who are already at the top of their game vying against other well-known, in some cases internationally known dancers. And will that story be enough to make people tune in week after week after week? I guess we'll see.
I admit, I have a soft spot for some of these competition shows. But why do you think Americans love them so much?
Well, at their best, they have several different kind of stories going on at the same time. I mean, the first thing is, of course, the average person who has the Cinderella story, you know, the waitress in Kelly Clarkson, the waitress in a bar who suddenly you discover that she has this world-class talent. So that's part of it. Part of it is, frankly, the celebrity judges, you know, watching somebody like Howard Stern or Simon Cowell do what they do. And then finally, in a way, you can sort of play along. You're a surrogate, you know, you can experience it right along with them. There's all these different stories playing out at the same time, and the best shows find a way to harness the best stories, and that's why you come back again and again, and that's why The Voice and America's Got Talent and American Idol were so successful for so long.
NBC's The Carmichael Show premiered season 3 on Wednesday. It's a family comedy, but this is interesting. The writers like to take on current events, and in this clip from season 2, Mrs. Carmichael tries to stop her husband from putting a Donald Trump campaign sign in front of their home.
Joe, you are not putting that on my lawn. I don't want people thinking some Tea Party 1%ers are living in this house.
Come on, there's a beat-up wash machine in the driveway. I'm sure nobody's going to think that.
All right, so that's funny. But the first episode in the new season tackled the issue of sexual assault. Kind of a tough issue to make comedy out of. How did they do, Eric?
Well, you know, this is a show that likes to take tough issues and kind of bounce them around the various characters in the ensemble. Gerard Carmichael is this up-and-coming comic, and it's centered on his life. So you can take an issue like sexual assault, and basically his brother is afraid that he may have accidentally sexually assaulted somebody and seriously kind of believes it. But they take that idea and they kind of explore it from the eyes of, you know, older Black Americans, younger Black people, and that way they kind of take the issue apart and try to have fun with it too. You know, it does harken back to these old sitcoms like All in the Family and Maude that used to do this regularly, and it's interesting that it feels so fresh now because other comedies are more subtle about how they talk about these issues, I think.
So I got to ask your opinion about this next one. There's some new game shows premiering this season. Jamie Foxx hosts a musical game show called Beat Shazam.
Tonight, three teams will battle it out to see who's the fastest at identifying the monster hit song. The quicker they answer, the more money they can make. And in the end, only one team is going to square off against the greatest musical mind on the planet. What's the name? Shazam.
This is based on the music app Shazam. But look, Jamie Foxx is an Academy Award winner. Do you find it strange that he's doing this?
Well, it's interesting. I sort of feel like Steve Harvey kind of opened the floodgates here. Steve Harvey is a guy who came along and hosted Family Feud, but he also has like a huge career as a stand-up comic. Of course, he has lots of other TV shows, and he decided to host a game show. And now, all of a sudden, I think the floodgates have kind of opened. So we see Anthony Anderson from Black-ish hosting a game show. We see Alec Baldwin hosting the Match Game. And now Jamie Foxx is probably the next iteration. Hosting these shows is not considered like the showbiz purgatory that it once was. Huh. And people are hosting these shows now who have robust careers in other areas. And it seems like a fun way to make extra money and to extend their brand in a way to show that they're capable of something that maybe people didn't realize they were capable of.
All right. NPR TV critic Eric Deggans, thanks very much.
Always a pleasure.